All right, good afternoon, everyone. We're still looking at Abigail Schreier's book, Why Bad Therapy, Bad Therapy, Why Kids Aren't Growing Up. Again, we're commending this book to you. We're looking at chapters 4 and 5 today. Social Emotional Meddling is chapter 4. Who's got the title for chapter 5?
The schools are filled with shadows.
The schools are filled with shadows. She is a good author, good writer, enjoyable to listen to, enjoyable to read, very articulate. She writes, the first time anyone suggested my then 7-year-old daughter had a lot of anxiety, I was not at the pediatrician, but at a parent-teacher conference. She's looking at the clock a lot at the end of the day, the assistant teacher piped up. She seems to have a lot of anxiety about missing the bus. We thought you should know. It seems unlikely that any teacher of a generation ago would have scrutinized the second grader's clock checking at the end of a 9-hour school day, much less having sprung this banal observation like a magician's reveal at a parent-teacher conference. I like the way she weaves in her own stuff, but not just her own stuff. She brings in an incredible number of experts at the same time. Thoughts on this chapter?
This was one that, because last week when we were talking about it, you know, you asked each of half the room to come in for each one. I was like, well, I can't skip a chapter because if I do, then I'm going to miss context. And I don't know about you guys, but I thought 4 was more beneficial than 5. But the social emotional meddling concept of what she started getting into, you know, I mentioned this the other week in our conversation, and it just seemed like she just reiterated and just proved what I thought, that I remember as in my early days as a teacher, having coworkers that recommended to parents that maybe their child needed to be diagnosed so that they could be on, you know, a small dose of something to help them, you know, function through the school day. And then so she says on page 70 that the teachers were most likely to be the first ones to suggest ADHD to children, which is just,
well, it's because the teachers are spending most of the time with this child. I mean, you think about 6 o'clock in the morning, 6 o'clock at night, and then you have dinner, you put the kid to bed, and then you take him back down to the school again. And are we dealing with like a balance of the degradation in behavior and values, and then combined with the onslaught of ADHD, like, is there any relationship between those two? Because she mentions over and over again in the chapter that teachers are articulating that the behavior of children has changed over the years. But I mean, we don't.
Which I would agree with, but right. I think the teachers are taking the easier way out of, you know, just medicate them and kind of to calm them down or to make them less
difficult.
Because difficult expectations have also changed.
Right.
Well, that's the easier solution. You know, the harder solution is that the parents really get involved with their children. You know, I think that's what she's suggesting is that.
Right. But I'm saying from the teacher's perspective, it's, oh, they have ADHD. Let's get them on medicine just to calm them down in the classroom or kind of give them that stupor so they're not as active.
Yeah, they're just one result.
For the teacher to have classroom management.
Mm-hmm. And you know, what's really funny about this chapter is two things happened in this chapter that she really takes a knock on, and I saw both of them in a Christian school recently, and it worked extremely well. But it was because it was handled from a Christian perspective, and it wasn't handled as described here, the way the public school was executing it. And one was the brain break. And what it was is, it was the idea of the brain break was, get them outside, let them run around for a few minutes, let them burn off some energy, and then put them back in the desk.
But it was a group.
It was
not
a group.
Like one kid.
It wasn't
after
like
another
one student after another. It was right. Basically, it was designed
like chapter 5. One can just get up and go do whatever he wants.
Right.
Yeah.
It wasn't that type of idea. It was the idea that they, as kids, they can only go so many minutes in a isolated seated position, instead of hours upon hours upon hours upon hours. And that's why they have attention deficit. That's why they're hyperactive, is because they weren't designed to be that way. They're kids. They're meant to play. They're meant to be out running around. They're meant to be energized. They're meant to be learning by experimentation. Even the girls are meant to be in social circles, communicating, playing, learning how to interact with each other, not in rows like factory workers being on the assembly line. And hey, you're at the math station, ring the bell. Now you're at the English station, ring the bell. Now you're at the, you know, that type of effect, which is what our education system is built around, the factory system. So it was the idea of, let's do it more the old-fashioned schoolhouse way, and we'll go so many minutes, and then we'll take a 10-minute break, run around, go back, go so many minutes, take a break, run around. And they had all these recesses built in, even in the high school. Mm-hmm. And then they went, and their grades were going up. But then they also had the idea of the circle that they talked about in here, but the circle wasn't the idea of, oh, let's just get our feelings out and a victim had to face their bully or anything like that. It was, no, you're sitting before a council that's going to judge whether or not you can stay in the school because you violated the school's rules, and this council's here and you've got to plead your case. It wasn't a, well, let's all get along, kumbaya. It was a, no, you're standing like in a group of your peers, and they're like a General Zod you've been found guilty of. And are you going to the Phantom Zone or not? In the opening of Superman or something, you know, that kind of effect.
And she makes a point too, kind of to your point there, Dr. Farmer, about the emotions check-ins. Like it's happening first thing with the class period, and that's setting the tone automatically. Like she has that comment, is it going to be a bones or a no bones kind of day, talking about the viral TikTok video. So the kids already have it implanted, like almost you know, just subconsciously in their minds that, okay, today's a no bones day. I'm not going to try. It's going to be a bad day.
Yeah. When you come in today, would you be sure to go ahead and pick whether or not you have a cloud or a sunshine and put it by your name, so I'll know how to handle you, please, Mr. Darius.
Yeah, absolutely.
let's be honest, we do that with people anyway. Oh, I'm going to go talk to them. All right, let me go ahead and put my clouds on.
Not quite the same.
We all have our nice voice.
But, you know, she was talking about that meta study, and she was saying that she kind of took a hit on the meta study, and it was the idea of them circling around the negative feelings. And I brought a little meta study book in with me here that put on the table, and it's by John Hattie. And there's a chapter in here on the student, and this whole book is nothing but meta studies and their effect on them. And it breaks it down, the home, the student, the learning environment, even the physical condition of the building, and what effect it has and everything else. And the students' feelings is by far one of the most impactful things on student outcomes. However, and negative feelings have a huge negative effect. Positive feelings have a huge positive effect. And I agree with her. If we circle around on their feelings and keep them focused on negative things, then we're not going to improve who they are. We're actually hurting them. We're making their grades go down. We're making everything destructive to their end.
Yeah, that rumination.
The rumination effect. So if we were to do anything with feelings, why would we not be reversing and reframing everything into, it's going to be okay. You can do it. You can get past this challenge. And especially in Christian schools, we should be like, hey, God's behind you, the Holy Spirit, this. If you accept Christ, then you'll have the Holy Spirit inside of you. And, you know, he's the giver of all wisdom. And then you have the giver of all wisdom indwelling you, and he will give you what you need in measure to what he wants you to have, so that you can pursue excellence, so that you can get past this fear, so that you can get past this challenge, so that you can overcome this. And remember, in your weakness, he is made strong. So you're glorifying him if you stand against this, if you stand up to this, if you do this, if you overcome this, if you, and everything's pushing them towards a positive glorification of God, then that should create positive outcomes. So there should be some kind of positive push in it.
So another,
Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to go to another topic on 73 and 74. It talks about the dual relationship. Mm-hmm. And so I think she's very fair in this book that she's not saying that there should not be any therapy. And she's not saying that
you're talking about the school counselor and the student.
Well, just across the board.
Okay.
The underlying current of the whole book is she's not saying that therapy is bad for everybody and that it can't help some people. But the way it's grossly used and overused, that's really where she's pushing in. And then she highlights how for decades, the American Counseling Association would say that people cannot do therapy if you have a dual role. If you know the person outside of therapy, you can no longer be their therapist because you're not going to be able to create a really healthy environment of conversation and working through things with that person. Well, now the ACA has changed that in 2006 and they're allowing it. She's saying that's a big problem when you get this in school is because you have people that are trying to do therapy and they know everything about this person's life. And so they're subjectively putting into the therapy what they know and that is totally unhealthy from a psychologist's standpoint.
Yeah, she addresses the fact that there was a therapist or a parapro. You know, what she references is an assistant counselor of sorts in the school that wasn't getting information directly from the students, but strategically placing themselves near students regularly so that they could gather that information.
Yeah.
Which was, you know, very much what that dual relationship concept is. You know, how does a school counselor sit down and objectively, I'll use the word counsel or work through a situation when they have so much insight? And I don't know about you guys, but as I've read through this, I in no way, shape, or form would claim to be a therapist, but I'm trying to extrapolate and correlate what are the synonyms between a therapist having conversations with a person and a pastor who's trying to evangelize and disciple a believer, and how we, you know, do or do not do the same, some of the similar type things. Now, obviously the objective is very different. There is no $250 an hour rate. There is not necessarily a stigma with talking with a pastor like there would be with a therapist, but still some of those same, you know, underlying currents of things have just caused lots of different thoughts in my mind.
And that's where I would say that, you know, two elements are different. One of those elements is we're doing a task-oriented mm-hmm. approach, and we're doing, if we want to call it, behavioral therapy. We're actually, you know, trying to talk them through their behavior needs to change, their identity needs to change.
Right.
And so I think that's different than what she's talking about and highlighting negatively in the book here.
Mm-hmm. And there are certain things that you're not bound by in legality. Like if a student teenager came to you and disclosed something in pastoral counseling, you're not legally bound to keep it from a parent if it was detrimental to their life. Mm-hmm. You're not bound to keep information, like I said, secret. And then in the same essence, you have to report. Yeah. And a counselor doesn't necessarily have to, because it can be kept under a medical shield.
Right.
Unless there's a chance of harm to another person or themselves, they may be able to actually keep it shielded unless there's a crime that's actually being committed. So in that essence, you know, they can be privileged to some level of criminality and not have to report it. Whereas as a pastor, you may have to, right, because of the accountability, their mandatory reporting. And it can have dire consequences that I don't want to put out on podcast, but I'd be more than happy to share with you after the podcast. I shared with Mike this morning. We kind of talked about a reason for my trip.
Right. So one thing within the chapter I do think we need to highlight is the social emotional learning. And she will reference that as SEL. That's the title that everything she's talking about in this chapter and the next chapter fall under. And her assumption in the beginning was that social emotional learning was basically the new terminology for character education. And she very clearly figured it out that no, character education, that was a positive. This is totally the invasive going into the back into the trying to work through the emotions with people in group therapy as adolescents and younger.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting because she goes into the, you know, as she's addressing that, where she'll say the idea on page 78 that good therapists know that it may be counterproductive to push a kid to share his trauma at school. Because then what ends up happening is they start using it as a crutch. And to where she addresses that there's a family that she tells the story of where, you know, the kids who are have been adopted, who have a terrible upbringing, but are now in at least a safe environment that that for all intents and purposes seems to be drug free and, you know, a physically healthy home. That now those kids are being asked to relive some of those things. And she comments that in the quote that this family is like, my kids don't need to be ashamed about their background because those children did nothing wrong, that they had drug addict parents. But because of the model, you're forcing them to bring that up.
And then the others that are in the class weaponize that against those kids.
Oh, yeah. Because there's no, and that she hasn't really addressed that necessarily. But when you're talking elementary school, middle school, like once students find out information about someone else, like they will bring that up to their benefit. And it will be a bullying situation or a taunting situation very quickly if they feel that they need to use that for them.
Are today's therapists, are they secular pastors?
That'd be a good terminology.
Yeah.
Yeah. Trying to fill that role.
Well, I mean, we have more nuns than anything else, right? Mm-hmm. So then who's going to step in and provide clear? The problem with the therapist is you have no idea what their value base is. There's no, mm-hmm. there's no uniform value base. If you go to your Methodist pastor in your local church, not today, but going back 50 years in time, you knew a lot of where he was going to come from. He believed that this was wrong and this was right. And you could have confidence that he would be. Now, how do you do that with a therapist? How do you find a therapist that shares your values as a parent? What do you interview the therapist first? And then are they going to fully disclose who they are, or are they all things to all people? And they're completely camouflaged as to who they really are.
Yeah, I think at least in the Christian counselor therapist world, I know Jay Adams is one of the big names that would come up in there. So I think to some extent, the schooling or the philosophy of counseling, I would think that there should be some information that how they would reveal like their particular method or target on how they're going to work with individuals, I think would be part of the outset. And then another aspect, and I know it's kind of difficult if you have no connections, but talking to other individuals who have gone through therapy or are working through therapy with that particular agency, and what has been a benefit or a detriment to them, or what's been their experience, you know, because we do that all the time. I mean, we look at Google reviews, Amazon reviews, everything, trying to figure out, is this worth my time and investment in doing so?
Well, you can almost rest assured that any therapists today in the United States more than likely prescribes to the ideological moorings of the liberals. And you're going to have somebody who is going to be affirming in their wokeness. And unless they come from a conservative school or in your interviewing process with them, have the approach of like the earlier guy did in the book, that they're going to have a specific treatment plan that creates a exit in it. If you're in Canada, you're definitely 99% going to have a leftist woke therapist, because a guy like Jordan Peterson is having his license pulled, which happened. He had to give it up because he would not prescribe to their ideology, and he can no longer actually treat anymore. That's why he just goes around speaking and writing books. But here in the United States, that's eventually going to happen. So when you see all of these people, you're going to basically have that dilemma, and you're going to see less and less of them because they're afraid of being attacked by the what do we say, the American Council, the ACA.
Well, and it's like it's hard to even find
medical books. Doctors.
Well, it's hard to find books written from a Christian perspective.
Yep.
Because I know, like, when my mom taught psychology in Bible college, you know, all the books that she found were still all, even though it was a Christian author, they were all rooted in the same secular psychology. And then they just threw a few Bible words in there. And, but, you know, she's like, it's, you know, she would tell the president of the college, she's like, this isn't Christian. You know,
well, yeah,
maybe a Christian author, but she said it's just secular psychology.
Well, the leading guy for Christian psychology right now for education is George Knight, and he's been there for decades. I don't even know if he's alive anymore, but Knight is the leading book, and his research is really a Christianizing of a person that she mentions. I can't remember if it's in chapter 5 or chapter 6. But Jean Piaget, Piaget and Erickson. Erickson's the leading researcher in social emotional learning in its earliest stages and created the social stages of life. And Piaget and Vygotsky, the guy, Piaget from France, Vygotsky from Russia, they're the guys who created the cognitive stages. One, your physical action creates cognitive realization. The other, cognitive thought creates physical action. They both have the same basis of stage development. It's just which one creates what first. I call them the same therapist. They just come from two different angles.
And that's where, from my opinion, as Brian mentioned, Jay Adams, you know, the nouthetic counseling. I think that is the most biblical counseling. And so if somebody was looking for somebody, that I would think they would need to check and see if they're coming from a nouthetic. To me, that's much more using scripture than it is what you guys are talking about, where it's just taking the secular psychology and putting a God twist on it. I think Adams really comes from more of a biblical perspective and an understanding of people and working that out.
Yeah.
But I did think we might need to go ahead and switch into
chapter five. Yeah, the schools are filled with shadows. That's your trailers.
Yeah.
That's the people who come along with a student and shadow them to help them out. And it might be an ABA specialist for a student who has special needs, but in your more affluent schools, as I was shocked to actually find that in this chapter because I've never actually experienced it, is somebody just walking along to basically make sure they know how to socially react to society.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't it a good time to tell Sally her hair bow looks nice?
Yeah, you want to share your lunch snack right now with Timmy. Yeah,
and
right.
I don't know if you guys have thoughts on this, but I was kind of walking through the dynamic between what the shadow would be as the therapist for someone who may be on the autism spectrum as an ABA therapist, and the more affluent aspect of some of that, because I only have the experience that I have. But Jack, we had a student that graduated from the academy a couple years ago who had an ABA therapist.
Yeah, we have one now.
And then, you know, my son currently has an ABA therapist with him a couple days a week.
So we have two.
And then there are our new intervention specialist was actually an ABA therapist that was with my son. But then as I've kind of watched these ladies interact and the specialist that was with the boy that's already graduated, her child is now in our academy because of her interactions with our school. And so as I look at what these ladies have done in the classroom, both as a dad and as the teacher in the room, where it was very much that, hey, this is a good time. You need to write this down. Okay, have you done this? And it was very much that coaching through the here's how you succeed in class. Would now it looked very different from a middle school student that I had. And it was, hey, he said this is a test or quiz, whatever. Get out your planner, write this down. Versus, you know, my son who, you know, was being told stop picking your nose. So very different perspectives, but still that very much the coach of walking them through. Here's how you navigate a classroom successfully.
Right. And she brought up the same as like you all mentioned in chapter four, you know, the balance in that. But I think what she really attacked in chapter five was so many parents are just wanting someone to pamper their child and keep them from actually dealing with adversity or accountability.
Yeah, it's a lot different than your son, Brian. It's the idea that a fully functioning student who has no need of a therapist or should have no need of a therapist having the shadow come along. Even more so than that, I think really the center thing that really drove this chapter is this idea that we have built a system of accommodations that have led to that should only exist for the most severe cases of individuals has been so freely given to almost everyone. And I hate to use the term everyone, but it is so freely given that it feels like everyone, that it has led to an incredible deterioration of school order, discipline, academic achievement, excellence, and has just created a case of rot. I mean, there's just no other way to describe it. The school system of America is rotting from the inside out.
Jack, and I think I know the answer to this, but I'm going to ask it for the sake of the podcast. We're also including IEPs from our public schools in this, correct? Because I didn't see that language anywhere in the chapter.
Well, because you're going to use 504s. 504 is the justification for an IEP. An IEP is simply an individual education plan. That means that a group of educators in an administration and some kind of specialist sat down and said, Pastor Sean needs an individual education plan because he's super smart and we're going to have him work and we're going to give him, let him read books above level, and we're given the approval and we don't want a teacher hindering that. So we're going to let him read one grade level above. That would be an IEP.
So an IEP on its own isn't a negative.
Isn't necessarily a negative.
I had an IEP from elementary school through junior high and high school.
And a lot of advanced students do and have in the past because they didn't have that ability or the school's
advanced reasons.
And Didi will go out every once in a while. Oh yeah,
because we do forget that many of the students on the high end of the scale are also special needs because they do have a special need. They get very bored in school. The
504, Jack.
The 504 though is a condition that requires an accommodation. In other words, there's something there medically that's requiring this specialized adjustment to the learning program. Extra time, headphones so the test can be read to them because it's been pre-recorded. They have a Braille textbook. The school has to buy them a Braille textbook, would come from a 504. So she really concentrated on that. What she's saying is ADHD shouldn't have a 504. Mm-hmm. She's saying that some of these conditions aren't severe enough to warrant 504s. They're meant for your children who have severe vision problems, hearing problems. They're meant for your children who can't navigate stairs well because of motor skill issues. They're meant for your children with an IQ that's super low.
And that's where she brings in the difference between adversity and dysfunction.
Yes, hormone imbalances that are medical, that they're not going to be able to overcome them.
But what we've done is take things that were adversity and should help a child grow up with resilience, and we've put an adversity into dysfunction categories.
Yeah.
So everything now is a dysfunction,
and we've taken that growth away. And she mentioned the restorative justice of 2014 that Obama came out with, but that didn't start it. She needed to go back to IDEA 2004, which was this idea of special education revamp from the 1970s. The first time it was redesigned. But that led to No Child Left Behind, which was George W. Bush's initiative, which then led to Obama's Race to the Top, which restorative justice was only a part of, which led to AYP, which is an annual grade that schools receive. And they get more money if the school is failing than they get if the school is passing. So a school that's in the C level will actually purposely fail to get money instead of doing the hard work to pass. So then that led to EOGs. So your homework doesn't matter as long as you pass the EOG, because the EOG gets you passed to the next grade. So it's not your grades that matter. It's whether or not you can pass that final test. That's a part of the restorative justice. And that led to expulsion as the last resort. And we gotta treat the problem. We can't punish the problem. So this leads to everybody must then have trauma, which led to the ACE indicators, which are physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, physical neglect, emotional neglect, mental illness, divorce, substance abuse, violence in the home, incarcerated parent. And if you have two or more of these indicators, then of course you're a victim of trauma. So therefore you fall under the protection of the restorative. So this created the alternative schooling and the alternative schools, where basically it's like a free for all prison.
And that's where Robert Anda was one of the original study developers that came up with ACE. And she documents him in the book, in the chapter there, how he talks about that the way ACE is being used now is totally a misuse from the way they originally studied it.
Yeah.
ACE being adverse childhood experiences.
Childhood experience. And what we've ended up with, and she makes the statement very well, students rise to the level of expectation. Pastor, we were talking yesterday, and I said, I told you it's an indicator. We were talking about a situation. I told you it's an indicator of students going to the label that they feel they've been assigned to. And this is why some schools don't have a lower level section. Even if it's a lower level section, they still call it honors, because the students, and they still give the students the regular level work, and they ratchet it up over the course to a true honors course because the students rise to it. But if they think they're in the basic level course, then they ratchet down to it. Wow. So, you know, it's a matter of, and that goes back to chapter 4, the idea of reframing. Mm-hmm.
So for all you parents out there that you're like, my kid doesn't fit any of those criterias that Jack's been talking about, I did find it interesting. There were two vignettes that were described. The first vignette was a bunch of kids that didn't know how to put a clip-on tie.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah. And then the other one, they couldn't order, couldn't even go to a restaurant, a fast food restaurant and order his own food.
Yeah. And I tell you, I remember listening to that a couple months ago. And the next time I had Autumn, I sent her into Dunkin' Donuts to get her own donut with $5 in her hand. You know, she's 8 years old. Mm-hmm. It was completely safe. I was outside. I was in the car. I was watching the door. There was one way in. There was one way out. You know, it was a safe experience. But if you want a donut, you have to go in there and talk to the adult yourself. You have to communicate it. You have to pass the money to them. You have to bring it back. You know, are we doing things like that? Or is there such a level of fear that we're debilitating our children without even realizing it under the guise of thinking we're protecting them? Where's the balance?
Or thinking that we're protected. And I forget what page it was on, but she addressed the fact that I think it was in the section talking about the band teacher, but that there was a child who had reported faithful, loving, traditional parents to social services based upon what was coming as a result of the school counselor. So what it looked like in the very short snippet of the story she gave was everything is lockstep at home and the kids still reported it.
And that's going to become very, that story, Brian, will become very critical to the central idea of the next chapter.
Right.
Chapter six, when they talk about the manipulation of memories and are there such a thing as memories being stored in the body.
Yeah. All right. Well, we hope you're appreciating this review and you're encouraged to take a look at this book and work through it. I promise you it will be a productive read for you. Audiobook is also excellent. She's a great reader. You'll enjoy listening to her as well. Thanks for listening to you. We'll get into the rest of the book next week.